Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, apes. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, General Lady P. No relation to Master P. Joining me today is model slash nuclear physicist, Miss Emma Gerard.
Reporting, sir.
She can talk and pout her lips at the same time. It's amazing. Also with us is baby-faced imperialist Mr. Martin Kessler.
It's satire, dummies.
Our last sight and sound entry was another heavy, dark entry. It was Scorsese's Taxi Driver. So for this week's podcast, we're doing another palate cleanser. Yes, allow me to lull you into a false sense of security. Today, our guest Martin Kessler is going to tell us why he thinks Paul Verhoeven's Starship Troopers deserves entry into the FlixWise favorites list. Because nothing lightens the moon like a little fascist allegory. Want to know more? Of course you do. Take it away, Martin.
Starship Troopers is a 1997 film that follows Johnny Rico, a square-jawed, very Aryan-looking Argentine living in an authoritarian utopia. He doesn't have much direction in life. He's bad at math, good at football, and spends most of his time with his girlfriend Carmen and his schoolmate Dizzy, who he just wants to be friends with, and his psychic friend Carl, who likes to tell ferrets what to do. At graduation, Rico's professor Ratjack gives him a good piece of advice, that figuring things out for yourself is the only freedom anyone really has, and that he should use that freedom. Of course, Rico fails to do this, and signs up for military service without a second thought in an attempt to impress the career-focused Carmen, who promptly dumps him. But Rico isn't alone in his training for the army. Dizzy is there, and Rico makes some new friends, whom we see in a shower scene are all very young, healthy, and full of hopes and dreams. That won't last. After a recruit is killed in a training accident, Rico thinks maybe he wasn't cut out for the military after all. Maybe he should leave. His mind is abruptly changed when his home city, Buenos Aires, is suddenly devastated by a meteorite. Blame is placed on giant space bugs from across the galaxy. For Johnny, the military, and even the media, this means war. Rico and his trooper comrades travel aboard starships to the distant desert planet Klendathu to kill all the space bugs. However, this doesn't go quite as planned. The bugs have been vastly underestimated, and most of Rico's friends are mutilated and killed. And Rico likely would have been too if he wasn't saved by his former Professor Radjek, now his lieutenant. Leadership changes, but the war goes on. Rico is sent with little justification to a completely different desert planet to fight bugs there. Dizzy and Rico finally get together, but there's not much time for romance because the bugs have laid a trap and people die. Radjek dies, Dizzy dies, so many horrible deaths. Again, Rico barely makes it out alive, only to learn from his friend Carl, now a high-ranking member of the military intelligence in a swanky Gestapo-style uniform, that Rico's mission never had much chance of success, and that he should go back to the planet and try and capture a brain bug. A bug that thinks. I'm sorry if you find that offensive. Anyway, even more people die horrible, horrible deaths, but Rico rescues his ex-girlfriend Carmen, and the terrified brain bug is promptly captured, dragged out of a big hole in the ground, and sent off to a military facility to have its orifices penetrated. Don't worry, that part is censored. So does this mean victory for our heroic fascists over the bugs? No, the war continues, and they need you, so sign up. I don't know if you'd like to know more, but I certainly would.
Excellent. Is that what that shower scene was for? I wasn't sure.
I've argued about the shower scene with people for like years and years, and I think it actually has a purpose in the film.
Well, I look forward to hearing it. I know I sort of prompted you into doing Starship Troopers, but we were talking about doing a Verhoeven movie. So why do you think Starship Troopers deserves entry into the FlixWise favorites list?
Well, I think it's an incredibly astute political satire wrapped up in a big, dumb sci-fi blockbuster-type film. It's probably one of the most subversive films, I think, to maybe ever come out of the Hollywood system. Like, as Paul Verhoeven and Ed Neumeier say on the audio commentary, it's a film about how war makes fascists of us all, and I think that point is made in a way that's very funny and very sad, giving us this propaganda film from the future. It's like a 23rd century version of Kohlberg, the famous Veith Harlan World War II German nationalist propaganda film.
Yeah.
And I think Starship Troopers, like, it borrows from the history of fascism to extrapolate into the future. And I think the end result is largely a critique of American society, which may be partly why it wasn't so well received initially. Well, people didn't really get Starship Troopers when it came out. You had critics like Roger Ebert and Richard Schickel from Time Magazine, and I think especially the Washington Post completely missed the point. It actually attacked the film for endorsing fascism.
Yeah.
I think Armand White hated it, but he actually got it, calling it a delirious cautionary fantasy on war and patriotism.
Right. I kind of want to talk about that. So this movie has a 63% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
Which does not necessarily knock it out of contention for the FlixWise favorites list, because see Zoolander. But, but it's bizarre how many critics either didn't get it or don't like it. So I guess my question is, do you think critics didn't like it or they didn't get it?
Well, I think there's this problem with confusing representation with endorsement.
Right.
You see that happen a lot, I think, with the American critics in particular, where you see something represented on screen and I think people, you know, it makes them uncomfortable and the reaction is negative to it, even though it's maybe something you should have a negative reaction to and the film is trying to provoke you with that.
Right.
I don't know. I think, like, I'm sure you can find European critics or critics elsewhere in the world that would have those reactions too, but I think maybe for some reason it seems more specific to America. I don't know if I'm off the mark, but
no, I don't think so.
I think also too, like, I kind of get why people didn't get the joke, because it's a film that only really became more relevant after the events of September 11, 2001 and the reaction to that. And I think there's so many parallels to draw between the events of the film and the reality that came after it that probably if it were made today, people would accuse it of being too on the nose, yeah?
Yeah, no, it is incredibly prescient. and I imagine a lot of people didn't get the joke in 1997 when this film came out. But it's hard for me to believe, because it does, as we're watching it now, it feels so on the nose. I'm wondering, I guess I should read more about this, but was the criticism about the satire, or was the criticism about, as we say, like, representation does not necessarily equal endorsement? Perhaps it's a little bit of both, but I wasn't able to find really great critiques of the satire.
No, well, I think most people didn't realize it was satirical, which is bizarre. Yeah. Like, it's got Doogie Howser dressed up like a Nazi.
It's not subtle.
Yeah, like, I think you look at like Roger Ebert's review and he's like, well, a lot of special effects and a lot of action, but maybe there's something fascist going on here. Like, it's...
yeah, 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 you think? but Emma, what do you think of the movie?
I wonder if people react negatively to it, especially like American film critics, because it so like implies the viewer in the satire. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not being removed and saying like you have to stand up for like a just society or here's what's going to happen. It's like, this is what America's like. Yeah. And it deepens that involvement, because like, it not just like works on a level of being a good science fiction story, but it also like, it has to exist as a movie because stylistically it like draws from all these familiar movies. Mm-hmm. And it reminds you like, hey, like these stories that you love are like part of why you're complicit in the way the society works.
Absolutely. Yes. I think that's the masterstroke of the film. Like, it absolutely does implicate the viewer, and like, it forces us to question why we're either trained or there's something innate in us that we ultimately, we will inevitably root for the humans, no matter how awful they are.
And if you're a film critic and you're like very invested in these movies that it's right, referring to, I can see how your like instincts to guard yourself would go up a little bit.
That's true. Yeah. And as someone who loves aliens, like my defenses go up a little bit, because I don't want to question why I love aliens, because I love it with all my entire heart and soul. And I feel like I need to say something bold here.
Okay.
I think this movie, the satire in this movie is sharper and more pointed than in Dr. Strangelove, because it does implicate the viewer in a way that Dr. Strangelove does not. And while they're very different films, I bring up Dr. Strangelove because it is probably the most famous and most celebrated satire about the industrial, the military industrial complex. But that film sticks exclusively, almost exclusively, to the generals at the top, the people at the top. So the people running the show in Doctor Strangelove are buffoons, and it takes only one psychotic breakdown by one general to destroy the world. Mm-hmm. And by the end of Doctor Strangelove, you get the sense that perhaps we're better off. You know, it allows you a remove. Like, it allows the viewer a sense of superiority. Whereas this film, I don't think it lets the viewers off the hook at all. I want to talk about casting in a minute, but by casting these essentially ciphers, these totally vapid Barbie dolls, and asking us to invest emotionally into their lives, the stakes of the film feel very real, mm-hmm. even though they are Nazis.
It also overcomes a lot of the typical hurdles that anti-war films tend to have, because I think, number one, the people who would benefit most from watching anti-war films aren't typically the kind of people who would go out and see an anti-war film.
Right, exactly.
And I think, in that way, Starship Troopers, it's really effective. And I think, even a lot of American anti-war films from the last 15, 20 years might actually have, jingoistic or militaristic values when you kind of unravel them to the core.
Right.
You know, I think, Saving Private Ryan, it's a film that starts and ends with shots of the American flag. I think you see these sort of anti-war films that pay lip service, but Starship Troopers is sort of the opposite, where I think, I can imagine people excited to watch it as an entertaining fantasy war movie and not anticipating the anti-war subtext and maybe being influenced by it in some way.
Absolutely. That's a really great point, that people who should see anti-war movies don't always necessarily aren't interested in seeing anti-war movies. So this one kind of pulls a fast one on all of us. But does that sit well with you that this movie is essentially mocking its audience? Does it bother you?
No, I think it's necessary to really have the impact that it does. I think a film that kind of caters too much to its audience, it wouldn't have this kind of potency.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, I agree. But let's talk about the way it dismantles the military and what exactly is the satire here. How is the military depicted? And I get, can we talk about that in more detail?
Well, it doesn't just, Saving Private Ryan just start in the middle of a war. We follow how military life is an integrated part of the society. It is in a lot of societies that there's a plan, where you go to school and you graduate and you reach a certain age that you can take entrance exams and be assigned to a certain, branch of the military, and that, these kids have these aspirations that they think that's what they want to do when they grow up. They're not recruited as part of war, so it's different than, I don't know, Full Metal Jacket, where you kind of feel bad for these people, getting recruited and then driven insane by their drill instructor.
Right.
There's more of a sense that everybody, it's just what they do.
Yeah. Hmm. And then beyond, so we get the recruitment stage and then war breaks out. And we see the hierarchies within the military. So direct parallels to the way our real life military is set up, where you have, what are they called?
The mobile infantry.
Mobile infantry. Thank you. Yeah. So, it's so closely parallels our own system that it's like I said, so on the nose. It's almost not even a parody. That is exactly how it works. The only the clear satire there, the only people of color in the movie are in the mobile infantry, and then throughout the ranks you have, it gets progressively wider until you have the translucent Neil Patrick Harris at the top. I know we talked about this a bit in the airplane podcast, but the characters are empty vessels in many ways. They're archetypes. Maybe empty vessels isn't fair, even though Casper Van Diem seems, and Denise Richards seem to have been just cast because due to their looks. Verhoeven doesn't seem to give a lot of thought to the acting ability. It doesn't seems like an afterthought. But despite that, I still find myself caring whether the characters live or die. So, how does that play into the satire?
I think it gets you invested in the story so that you don't check out at a certain point. I think
there's only so much beratement an audience might take while watching a film, and I think the story, it's strong enough that it keeps you invested in what's going on. And
yeah, I mean, so Scott Rosenberg from Salon said, I think when this came out, there's nothing wrong with good satire, but it's self-defeatingly stupid to inject it into any story that expects us to care what happens to the characters.
I think it's actually kind of the opposite. I think when you're watching something that's just purely satirical, you can only take so much of it.
Yeah.
I think when you care, I think that's when the satire really sort of cuts, actually.
Yeah. So do you care what happens at the end of Dr. Strangelove? I'm curious.
Well, Dr. Strangelove, the only kind of story thread I actually get really invested in is the people on the airplane,
The
bombers. Like, I'm actually kind of rooting for them at a certain point that, like, in spite of everyone trying to stop them, they manage to end the world.
Like, you can't kill James Earl Jones.
I know!
He was the host of Long Ago and Far Away. You hosted a PBS show when I was a kid, you're automatically a saint.
Yeah, so, okay. I mean, I guess, again, I'm sort of reiterating the same point as before, but I absolutely think it's essential to invest. And I think that's the film's great strength, is that despite everything, we still care. Because I think more than just being a really potent satire about the military and about totalitarianism, it gets to, like, just our basic human instinct for, like, the fight for survival. It totally exploits that brilliantly,
mm-hmm.
You know?
But it exploits our empathy, too. Like, that's a huge part of it, too. Like, it's not just a coincidence that, you know, psychic ability is a part of this story. Like, we're supposed to learn at the end that the bugs are very similar to us, and they do care. And they understand that we are other human, like, or that we're other life beings that die and have feelings, and they're just trying to not be destroyed by us and to learn more about us in the process.
Right, exactly. I mean, that the scene at the end where they capture the brain bug and Neil Patrick Harris's character has his psychic link with the bug and announces to the roaring crowd that the bug is scared, and everybody cheers in delight. that scene specifically for me recalled the end of Aliens. I know I keep bringing this up, but the mother at the end of Aliens, the female bug, just directly reference that movie. And I just went on this whole, like, deep dive thing with that scene, like, reading, like, all this, like, post-structuralist stuff yesterday in preparation for this. It's like the whole, reading about Abjection and what, do you know, I think her name, Julia Kristeva? Her whole writing about, like, the archaic mother and how this fear of objection causes us to cast off, which is no longer useful to us. Like, what that once was alive and now is dead, and that, like, that's a very innate human fear. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're so scared of the alien mother in Aliens.
Yes.
But in this film, like, it turns that on its head. It's like, why are we rejecting our mother? Why do we find this so horrible?
Right. And I think that brain bug is unquestionably coded as, like, this feminine thing.
Right, exactly. We talked about the shower scene briefly, but the whole society is totally gender neutral. And I wondered initially why Verhoeven chose to do this. And then it occurred to me, because there's only one female in this movie, and it's that brain bug.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah.
And I think, like, it's almost like there's too much testosterone in the society. And right. I think in the world of Starship Troopers, by women being so defeminized, I think, like, it does feel like it's a very masculine society that they're in.
Right, right, yeah. No, I think that's exactly the point, is that despite having female parts, there's no feminine characteristics in this society. And I can't really think of any exceptions. Even I'm trying to think of how Rico's mom was portrayed, if she's at all motherly or
yeah, and
maternal.
There's still like kind of like traditional gender roles, like everyone like has like their prom date, you know, at the beginning and stuff like that. But in the arena of politics, there's a separation, but it's not because of gender. It's because of whether or not you've served military service.
Right, right. It's very clear that women do have important positions within the government. I think the military commander is replaced in the beginning by a woman, I want to say. So,
yes.
But basically, like, it doesn't matter what gender or what sex you were born, it's gender plays absolutely no role because there is only one monolithic war, militaristic culture that is very hyper masculine. And then the one moment of fear, of explicit fear, is with the brain bug, and possible exception with Dizzy when she's dying.
The scene where Dizzy dies actually really bothers me every time I watch this because it does sort of feel like she's really, really afraid of dying. And like the scene that follows with the funeral where Rico just kind of regurgitates this rhetoric that he learned in school and now he actually believes in to sort of justify it to himself that this death was somehow okay, that she was doing her job. But I like there's this whole idea that's introduced with the bugs at the beginning, how they're perfect soldiers because they have no fear of death. And I think you see that the humans in the film are sort of encouraged to actually have the same attitude that, you know, they're supposed to do their job and not be afraid of dying for their society. But I think the film shows you that you should definitely be afraid of death and maybe be wary of military service.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk about, do you think this film, did it recall any other films? I know I've mentioned Aliens several times, but this came out in 1997, year before Independence Day. I believe this is also the era of Men in Black. So is this movie kind of just a direct response to those movies? Maybe I'm just obsessed with Aliens and that's why it reminded me so much of that. But like this was this was a big time for alien invasion, basically.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't just reference like 90s sci-fi movies, though. It goes further back. I think there were definitely a lot of like 2001 in there.
Yes.
The telephone call is the first one off the top of my head, but there was probably a little Star Wars in there.
Yeah.
I think there was one particularly Star Wars-y moment. When the ship's docking or something. I don't know. Somebody's saying goodbye and there's like definitely this like John Williams like music moment with like the sky, like the stars in the background. And,
yeah.
What else? I think there was a little bit of Apocalypse Now in there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's certainly, Verhoeven is well versed in the cinematic war oeuvre. Mm-hmm. Very fluent.
Yeah. And then the whole movie just feels like overall familiar, mm-hmm. too, which is what makes it work.
Right. Yeah. But what was going on in the 90s? Why were we so obsessed with alien invasion?
Well, I think there's this idea that a society has to somehow define itself by its enemies. And like the 90s, that was a period when the Soviet Union had collapsed and the United States was sort of the sole superpower of the world. So I think a lot of these films, in order to feel like there was some kind of enemy when you're watching a film, a realistic enemy, they had to resort to superpowered aliens from beyond the stars.
Excellent points. So let's talk about the performances.
Okay. I think this is probably the most controversial thing about the film. Yeah.
What do you make of the casting choices? Martin.
I think it works.
Yeah.
I think it really does sort of recall these propaganda films of the past. I think, like, of course, Nazi propaganda films, but I think also American propaganda films, the Frank Capra films, Why We Fight series. Even, like, I mean, people would probably argue whether or not they're propaganda films, but I think when you watch even, like, recent propaganda films, like Act of Valor or The Lone Survivor with Mark Wahlberg, there's a similarity in the performance.
Who doesn't think that's propaganda?
I don't know. People would fight me.
Like, that was practically made on behalf of the state.
Right.
You could argue anything else.
But, like, I think if you watch the performances in those films, it's very similar. And I think, like, it just feels like this aesthetic of perfection taken to the extreme. And I think it feels like it's an uncompromised American aesthetic that you're watching in this film.
Well, that's depressing.
I'm sorry. I think, like, if you think about what appeals to the broadest range of people, this feels like this is the least offensive aesthetic thing you can do with the performances and just even the cinematography. I was thinking how it feels like the most 90s kind of cinematography where everything's very sort of evenly lit and there's, like, these poppy kind of colors, like the bugs are yellow and green and blue. It feels like just how I imagine the 90s.
I love that.
The aesthetic for propaganda is always, like, freaking fantastic. And, you know, true. Like, I guess World War II is, like, the people still, like, admire World War II art. Like, they love, like, Russian communist art. Like, the, you know, German fascist aesthetic was pretty spot on.
Yeah.
But, like, but the American one was, like, established by, like, Hollywood and, like, Disney.
Yeah.
And, like, oh my gosh, like, those Disney propaganda movies are so cool.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of cheery, like, upbeatness of it is, like, definitely there in those, like, web video segments.
Yeah, absolutely. But this movie, along with Showgirls, another Verhoeven classic, you get the sense that the cast is sort of divided into those that are in on the joke and those that are not. And I, watching this movie, I did not get the sense that Denise Richards or Casper Van Dien were in on the joke. Whereas I felt like Neil Patrick Harris probably was. Just the only real indication that I got that he understood what was happening was at the end when his, like, one of his eyes starts drooping. All right, Neil Patrick Harris.
I think, I think it's in the audio commentary with the cast where Neil Patrick Harris says, like, there was never a moment when Paul Verhoeven or Ed Neumeier sort of said, this is what the film is about, but you just show up one day and your costume is, like, a Nazi uniform and you sort of realize what's going on.
They kind of leave it to you to catch on. But again, does that feel exploitive to you?
I don't, maybe it is exploited, but I think it's sort of necessary to get the performances that make the film work. I think if everyone was in on the joke, there'd be just way too much winking. I think sometimes you do see these films that are way too self-aware, and, like, you can tell the cast isn't taking it seriously, and it kind of ruins any sort of serious point a film might be trying to make with its own ridiculousness.
Yeah, yeah. But Paul Verhoeven has made a number of films, many of them misunderstood and then later reevaluated. But why do we think that this film deserves entry and something like Showgirls or RoboCop or Total Recall does not? I mean, I don't want to put too many Verhoeven films. So do we think this is his masterpiece?
We can't be like Sight and Sound where we just have like five Verhoeven movies at the top.
Maybe we should. Maybe I should consider it. but I think this, the direct comparison can be made to both Total Recall. I guess all of his films are somewhat similar. Showgirls feels like an outlier because it is such a weird movie.
I personally think, like, Showgirls, I don't think it's his best film, but I think it's probably his most misunderstood. And I think one, maybe not problem, but one quality of most of Verhoeven's films in Hollywood is he's usually working against his scripts. I think, like, when you read Joe Esterhaus's scripts, I think, like, they're not in line with Verhoeven's personal beliefs or aesthetics, and he's trying to subvert it. I think when he was working with Ed Neumeier, he's working with a screenwriter who really could work in collaboration with Verhoeven to reach a common goal. And I think Robocop is a fantastic film, but I think they sort of refined what they were doing with that. Yeah. And I think, like, if you look actually at the Sight and Sound submissions, there's several Paul Verhoeven films that got maybe one or two votes, Showgirls included.
Yeah.
You know, and I think also his, like, Turkish Delight, I think, is on there. And I'm going to make a prediction that on the next Sight and Sound poll, on the 2022 one, because I think a lot of Verhoeven films are only being reassessed now, I think probably there's going to be enough people rallied behind one Paul Verhoeven that you're going to see it on the list for real. And I think chances are it's going to be Starship Troopers.
Really?
I think we're going to look back and see Starship Troopers as maybe one of the best comments on post 9/11 America, even though it was made before it.
Yeah. You mentioned Showgirls as being sort of his most misunderstood film.
Yes.
And I think that's the film that, a lot of people are very fond of that movie. It's the most polarizing. People who love it seem to really love it and get very defensive, and then others are very dismissive.
I think even a lot of the people who love it in kind of a campy, right, ironic way.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people make fun of Showgirls for not being sexy, and I think that's kind of the point, is you're not supposed to be aroused watching this film, and I think that's somehow seen as a shortcoming of the film, but it's really a woman trying to succeed in a world where everyone's trying to exploit her. And I don't know, like, Paul Verhoeven, there's few filmmakers who worked in Hollywood that ever had the ability to eat their cake and enjoy it as much as that phrase, to have their cake and eat it too as much as Paul Verhoeven has. And I think, like, just a consequence is sometimes he was trying to do something very subversive to the point where it undermined people's ability to watch it on that kind of surface level. But a lot of his films have been appreciated by other filmmakers. Like, I know David Lynch is a big fan of Paul Verhoeven, Jim Jarmusch. And I think you can maybe see that reflected in some of the films they've made.
Absolutely. I know Jacques Rivette is a huge Showgirls fan.
Yeah, Jacques Rivette is a huge Showgirls fan, which I love.
The reason why I think Starship Troopers works and maybe not so much Showgirls works on some levels. It's a movie that is explicitly about exploitation. And it, as you said, it has its cake and eats it too, where Verhoeven is absolutely taking part in the exploitation. And that sort of diminishes my ability to enjoy the film, or even, like, I don't know. It seems like that in that instance, maybe you shouldn't have it both ways. And I don't know why that's the case for that movie necessarily, and not for Starship Troopers, because I enjoy the crap out of Starship Troopers. Like, we've talked a lot about how it's a brilliant satire, but it's also just, like, fun to watch. And we also, another thing that I wanted to touch on briefly is this versus RoboCop and why we feel this is superior, which I don't know about you guys, but I absolutely do. And I guess for me, the reason why I prefer Starship Troopers to RoboCop is because while I do end up feeling a tremendous amount of sympathy for the main characters, RoboCop is lambasts purely the, again, it's more like Dr. Strangelove, where it's the top of society that gets made fun of, but it sort of lets everyone else off the hook. And it's very, very pro-police, which does not play as well in 2015 as I imagine it did on its release.
Right.
And it's still very, very difficult to make any kind of movie that criticizes police, even now. And maybe that'll change. But I just don't know that RoboCop's satire is sharp enough mm-hmm. at this point. It's a really fun movie.
It is, and like, it is sharp satire, but it's not as sharp as Starship Troopers. And like, I don't. RoboCop does go around shooting criminals' dicks off.
That's true.
RoboCop, it's also a much more hopeful film than Starship Troopers. Like, the end of RoboCop, you know, he loses his memory, his family, his body, but he kind of gets to keep his soul. And mm-hmm. there's not really that in Starship Troopers. Nobody keeps their soul, and everyone I like dies.
It's true.
It's so pessimistic. It's saying, you know, the culture, it's broken.
Indeed. So, any final thoughts before we put this to a vote, Emma? Nothing?
Nah, I'm pro trooper.
Martin, anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think that's it.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm going to put this to a vote. So, Martin, I know you presented this to us, but do you think Starship Troopers is worthy of inclusion in the FlixWise favorites list?
I hope so. I think so, yes.
Emma, how about you?
Yes.
Okay, I think so too. And
we can get back to RoboCop and Showgirls later.
Yeah. another episode. We'll revisit. And that's the way we frame it. FlixWise, that is. If you have any comments you'd like to share, come find us on our website, FlixWise.com. Or you can congregate with your fellow citizens on Facebook at Facebook.com/FlixWise. You can follow me on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. We welcome all opinions, except for the dissenting ones. And if you think you'd like to join the fight, you can rate us and leave us a nice comment on iTunes. Come now, people. Time to do your part. On the next podcast, we're back on Sight and Sound duty with the 33rd movie on the greatest of all time list. It's Vittorio De Sica's Bicycle Thieves. So have those Kleenex handy. Until then, Martin, thank you so much for submitting Starship Troopers to the FlixWise favorites list.
Thank you for having me.
Emma, nicely done, Lieutenant.
It was an honor.
Until next time, remember, diligence, people, diligence. The enemy is out there.